Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Fresh, which is a film about Tinder and cannibalism, I guess. Except it's, I guess, not really about Tinder because they don't meet through an app.
No, it's a meet cute IRL.
Meet cute.
Very good. That's what we should have called it. I was about to joke that they met in meat space, as it's sometimes known, as opposed to cyberspace. But meat cute. Very good. Very droll.
Film follows a young woman named Noah who is wading through just the morass that is dating in the year of our Lord 2022, which is part of the reason why I went in the Tinder direction, I guess, because...
Well, that's kind of how the movie is pitched, too. Yeah. The Hulu blurb says something about the perils of modern dating.
The film opens with her just dealing with a bunch of grody dudes on apps.
Yeah, getting unsolicited dick pics and going on a first date from hell to this sushi place or something or other where he's just kind of a boar and a boar also to keep the wordplay train
just keep that
right
rolling
along. Yeah,
she meets this charming fella named Steve in the grocery store, and we'll get to it when we get to it.
We open with Noah, is that her name?
Yes.
On the aforementioned first date from hell. Guy's wearing this douchey scarf, looks for all the world like the quintessential 21st century hipster, but he's talking for some reason about how women of his mother's generation used to care more about femininity and not wearing baggy clothes. He doesn't exactly look like Robert Mitchum, you know? Like,
yeah, he's not wearing a fucking suit and tie. He's wearing a scarf indoors.
It's like, okay. So, I mean, if he were walking the walk and talking the talk, it'd still be douchey, but it'd be a lifestyle choice. Instead, he just seems like a hypocrite who maybe wants to fuck his mother. I don't know. Don't know where he thought that whole spiel was going to get him. So she's obviously not taken with that. He commits any number of other faux pas, the last and most significant of which is after she spurns his advances. He calls her a bitch or something. And then,
yeah, I didn't like you anyway. I was just being polite.
Yeah.
Stuck up bitch. Good luck finding a man, etc.
So Noah's got a best friend whose name escapes me.
Molly.
Molly. And the two of them are commiserating. And Molly's a bit of a man-eater. Noah is...
Man and woman-eater,
yes,
I think.
Noah's more withdrawn. Hasn't been with anyone in a while. And she has the meet-cute with the guy, the handsome Sebastian Stan guy in the grocery store where he's making weirdo small talk about cotton candy grapes, and then the two of them hit it off. They exchange numbers and wind up going out. He's charming enough but a little off-putting at the same time, but she's receptive. And you know, he's asking, given that you know what the premise of the film is, there are red flags mainly to do with him ascertaining that she's an orphan, for example, with no siblings, you know, that she doesn't, you know, I don't talk to my mom anymore. I don't know where she wound up, that she's basically only got Molly. So he proposes, they sleep together, and then shortly thereafter he proposes they go out of town. Molly doesn't like the sound of that. Noah says that she's just going to go for it, which is out of character for her, but she's trying to throw caution to the wind because she likes this guy and trusts him, although that trust begins to erode as they hit the road the following day and she's not getting any cell phone reception and he's being a little bit evasive. And he's got this weird explanation about how, oh, they can't get going where they're going today. Cottage Grove, is that what he calls it?
Yeah.
Some kind of nature retreat. He says they can't go there, they'll have to wait until the morning because
traffic.
Traffic. Yeah, it's not a very half-assed explanation. So they go back to his place. He slips something in her drink. She passes out, and then we get our title drop,
which is, we've been
25 minutes, maybe
more than half an hour.
Huh.
I think I read somewhere actually before we watched it, just I happened to stumble across this factoid. It was 33 minutes in, so we're being uncommonly brisk in our synopsis. We just processed half an hour of the film in about 4 minutes.
Yeah, well, this is where my note-taking began in earnest. And also, everything before the title drop is very much the... I hate when movie critics use the word meditation when the movie is just about that. It's like, not everything is a meditation, okay? But the first half hour and change of this movie does feel like a meditation on dating. And so it's almost like a short film. Everything preceding the credits is of a piece. And then after the title drop and the credits roll, it turns into a very different beast. And so it is
it's like a Pixar movie. It comes packaged with its own short film.
Yeah, right. Or sort of an aperitif before the main course, if you will. Right? Aperitif precedes, or is that like a dessert? I can never remember if it's an appetizer, like a pre-meal post-meal.
It's a drink that precedes.
Aha, okay.
Afterwards is a digestif because it helps.
Very good.
Digestion.
So it is relatively easy to breeze briskly through the first half hour or so. First half hour might be the highlight of the whole movie for me, so I don't mean to give it short shrift, but plot-wise, it has little bearing on what's about to happen. So Noah comes to in this room that's relatively spacious by hostage standards, but is, you know, she's a hostage. She's on a cot in the corner. She's handcuffed to the wall, and he starts bringing her food on a tray and monologuing at her most villainously. He gives her the skinny, which is that he's not going to subject her to sexual violence or even conventional violence.
Right.
He's going to carve her up one piece at a time while she's still alive and sell her meat to his clientele, wealthy cannibals, I guess. And, you know, I like Sebastian Stan in this role for the most part when he's telling her what fate he has in store for her. And we never really see any of this again or get wind of it ever again. But when he's telling her what's going to become of her, he says that he's going to take, he says, like, meat, hair, weird shit. He's got a line where he acts like even he's a little icked out by it, which is performative, I'm sure. But that was kind of a funny note.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But there's no scalpings anywhere that I remember. But that's
I figured at least somebody was going to end up with like a shaved head, uh-huh. You know, even if he doesn't have to take the skin off with it.
Well, because what he does is he sends little mementos, keepsakes, belongings of his victims to his clients. They get like a little care package. They open it up and you've got the meat, you know,
vacuum sealed.
Yeah. The piece de resistance. But then you've got all the supplemental material too, undergarments and pictures, hair sometimes, I guess.
You know, weird shit like that.
Yeah. So this is his trade. She sort of ceases to be the film's protagonist for a stretch here. I mean, she has no autonomy down there in the bunker. At one point, there's an escape attempt. She asks him for a shower, and so he accompanies her upstairs to the bathroom. And she, I think, like, elbows him in the gut or something and tries to make a break for it. And he subdues her. And then immediately thereafter, she wakes up on an operating table and he's amputating her ass cheeks. And this is where the movie sort of, I don't want to say jumps the shark or goes off the rails, because it feels like it's less like a building collapsing and more of a controlled demolition. You know, it's like the movie has decided that it's just going to implode a little bit or get weird. And I didn't love that direction. And not even like plot wise. I mean, tonally, I wasn't completely sold on it. There's another scene not long before this one, not long before the ass amputation, where he is sort of risky businessing around his kitchen while he's carving up a woman or what's left of one.
Yeah, right. Listening to the song Obsession by Animotion, I believe.
I couldn't say. He's bumping some other 80s pop ballad in the operating room when he's amputating her ass cheeks. She, you know, is heavily sedated but still conscious. So it's fairly horrific, needless to say. And then she spends much of the next half hour recuperating from that loss. Meanwhile, her friend Molly, this was very reminiscent of Get Out, the buddy in Get Out doing his cyber sleuthing.
Right.
She is corresponding, she's texting with Noah, who in point of fact is actually, what Steve. Did he say? His actual name, we come to find out, is
well, okay, so his name is like Brendan Stephen Kemp or something.
Yeah.
And to his victims, he goes by Steve.
Right. So she's been texting him, posing as Noah, and he's been giving her these kind of clipped responses to her questions, just raising her eyebrow. And what seals his doom is that he sends her a photo of a waterfall that they presumably took on a nature hike or something. And she does a reverse image search, and it's a stock photo, or, you know, taken from some blog.
Some website, yeah.
So alarm bells start going off. She goes to the bar where Noah and Steve or Brendan or whoever had their first date, second date.
Only
date.
Date, I think.
And because she knows the bartender. They had a fling once. So she grills the bartender for information. Did he use a credit card? What can you tell me about him? And based on this lead, she tracks down the guy's house and goes to confront his wife because he has...
I think wife she and calls children.
It, yeah, a whole ass life or something like that.
She says whole ass other family, and I remember this because
other
I
family
commented to you. Yeah, other family. It's not like he and Noah got married, had a couple of kids,
yeah,
and then he went
please,
nuts.
He's a cannibal, not a bigamist. Please.
Some things are beyond the pale, even for Steve.
Mm-hmm. So the wife says, "You've got the wrong house." Noah had previously sent Molly a photo that she took of Steve when he was sleeping, and his face is half concealed behind a pillow. And the wife is playing dumb. Is that him? I can't really tell. And you think at first maybe she's just like a mob wife. She's just kind of in denial, but
right.
not complicit. That's not the case. When Molly is preparing to leave, Steve, or Brendan actually, has come through the door at this point. Molly rings Noah's phone, and it starts going off.
And he
Brendan's
drops the
pocket.
Act.
Yeah. And so does the wife. They both sort of wheel around on her and subdue her. The wife brains her with some
Whatever.
Blunt object.
Yeah.
So this is where Noah has never like dropped out of the picture, but this is where she starts to re-enter it in a more proactive sense. She's been talking all this time to a cellmate, an unseen neighbor in a different holding cell whose name also escapes me.
You're just not very good with names.
I don't yeah, it's not my forte.
Penny. Yeah.
The two of them are sort of keeping each other sane, and there's another one who is beyond
not kept sane.
Yeah, beyond help in that regard, who I don't think we ever actually see in the flesh.
Well, because I don't think there's any of that left.
Yes.
By the time we get to the climax.
Well, and I was hoping for a reveal along those lines, as macabre as that might sound. But I feel like you, I was waiting for a more extreme iteration of that great moment in Sin City, the first one, where the woman's like, "He made me watch!" Do you remember that? The mm-hmm. Elijah Wood eats her hands or something, or makes her eat her own hands, or whatever sick shit he was into in that movie. It's been a few years. I just wanted to see what had become of her, and nothing ever materializes, which is okay, I guess, because this is ultimately a movie that's not really trying to be a freak show, ass amputations notwithstanding. It's in the final analysis to do with, I guess, sisterhood and solidarity. And so maybe showing a quadruple amputee who's irretrievably insane would have been not conducive to those ends. More speculation on that front after the break, I imagine. So Noah sort of deduces, with a little help, she sees something scrawled in a magazine that Brendan gives her to read to pass the time, a note from one of the other prisoners to the effect of, "If you're reading this, that means he likes you, stay strong," that kind of thing. So the plan,
use it,
yeah, the plan that she hatches is to get into his good graces to the extent that she can. She's also learned, talking to Penny, that it's a little bit out of his usual MO to sleep with his victims, to have sex with the women that he carves up. So she thinks maybe she can, with the aid of Cupid's arrow, get her way out of there, which is what she proceeds to do.
Yeah,
she
maybe he's not 100% lying when he says, "I like you," etc.
Yeah. So banking on that, she feigns an interest in sampling long pig, you know, the forbidden fruit. And he sort of tries to call her bluff. They have a couple cannibal meals the two of them, and they have small talk. And this, the outside of the opening act, you know, the overture, whatever you want to call the stuff before the title drop, this is the highlight of the movie for me, just the two of them sort of whining and dining, but in this way that plays like a grotesque, perverse version of the seduction that we saw at the beginning of the movie, you know, where he's still kind of acting just like this goofball. She makes this really horrendous, in every sense, dad joke at one point about, you saved the breast for last. And he like titters at that and is just kind of tickled by it. And it's stomach churning in a good way. So this culminates in a candlelit dinner, which feels less like he's calling her bluff and more like he's actually courting her again. We've had a little bit of a window into his marriage at this point. There's a pretty gnarly reveal when it's revealed to us that his wife has a prosthetic leg. So she was consensually, I imagine, cannibalized at one point. And so their relationship is pretty warped, as it would have to be, but it's also even more depraved than we might initially be given to assume. So you get the sense that she, more than condones the cannibalism, is neck deep in it, same as him, but she draws the line at infidelity, you know, that she doesn't want him playing with his food, to be crass. So at this candlelit dinner, the two of them are sort of picking each other's brains, not in the Ray Liotta sense. Although these scenes did very much remind me of that.
Yeah.
She invites him to dance. There was a scene before the title drop where they were dancing together and goofing off. And here we get sort of a regurgitation of that. But we know that she has something up her sleeve. There's a dangling uncertainty that I wish the movie had leaned into a little bit more. And this would have made it more like Hannibal, the Thomas Harris book, rather than the movie. And I might talk about this more after the break. In the movie, is it Julianne Moore in the movie?
Yeah.
Rather than Jodie Foster. In the movie, Clarice is completely icked out the whole way through that scene, is just gagging and just a complete captive. Whereas in the book, Clarice is in a state of like semi-hypnosis and is heavily sedated and is sort of under Lecter's spell a little bit more. And that's kind of the make or break moment where she's either going to eat Ray Liotta's brains, Paul Krendler, I think is the character's name, or she's going to stand her ground. And it ends very differently than the Ridley Scott movie, let me put it that way. And so I wish that Fresh had teased that possibility a little bit more, like maybe she actually is being taken in by him and she is maybe going to become the next Bonnie to his Clyde, his cannibal Clyde. But in any case, she springs her trap on him. She's preparing to go down on him. And then we see the teeth come out and she just chomps his dick off, which is very satisfying. In the ensuing fracas, well, she locks him into his bedroom and then goes to free the other women. Oh, her friend Molly has been taken captive. That probably goes without saying ever since she got
knocked out.
Yeah, knocked out. But she is in an adjacent cell.
It's her breast meat, incidentally.
Right.
First they allude to it. He said, you might find it familiar.
Right.
And then she's in a hospital gown the whole time, but she occasionally, like when she swings her arm violently or something, she kind of winces and touches her chest. So that, you know, that's pretty much confirmation.
Yeah, and Penny, when we lay eyes on her for the first time, is missing a leg. So she's hobbling around. But in the ensuing fracas, because of course Brendan breaks out of the room and the four of them go at it, there is a fair bit of biting, actually, which I was rooting for. I wanted them to just go, like, suddenly last summer on his ass and, like, eat him down to the bone. But, you know, just go full Romero mode. But it wasn't meant to be. Although, she does eat his dick off, so that's pretty good as far as these things go. So they subdue him, like, once or twice, I think. Finally, it seems fairly definitive. They get him several times with a meat tenderizer, tenderize his head, but good. And then the three of them are limping outside. The bartender shows up, and I knew, this being the kind of movie it is, that this wasn't going to be a standard cavalry situation where he was going to save the day. I thought he'd be a little bit more useful. Like, yeah, the buddy in Get Out shows up too late to make a meaningful difference, but he arrives just in time to lighten the mood. And I guess that's the function of this character, too, just because he does crack wise a little bit. But the long and the short of it is that he just fucking bails.
Yeah, he hears gunshots and he's like, nope, 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 nope. I've seen this movie before.
So they never even cross paths. I mean, from the women have no way of knowing that he ever even
was there.
He was there. Strictly for our benefit. So the gunshots are Brendan. He's staggering around in Jack Torrance fashion.
I was just going to say, doing his, Danny!
Yeah. Noah! Just firing blindly into the trees. And the three of them get the drop on him. Again, wrest the gun from him. And Noah gives him one between the eyes. And he stays down, obviously. So then his wife and her, I guess, manservant, bodyguard.
Well, I think it's the guy. There is a scene or a few shots near the middle of the movie after Steve is dancing to Obsession and vacuum sealing meat and packing it up. There's a guy who picks up some boxes, presumably for shipment.
Right.
And I think it's that guy.
That was that guy. Right, you are.
So, yeah, he and the wife have shown up and they find Steve's corpse. And she says, better get him on ice. I'm like, oh, shit. All right.
An eye for an eye, I guess. Although I suspect it's more than his leg that she's going to be wetting her whistle with. He's got it coming anyway. So the wife doesn't last very long. All the way through this climax, I kept waiting for the wife to show up because I knew that they had left that thread dangling. There's a scene where the two of them are in the bathroom together, Mr. and Mrs., and she seems uneasy. It's just before she gets in the shower and we see her prosthetic leg and her stump. She seems to be ill at ease with him spending so much time with this one prisoner in particular. Right before the candlelit dinner, I think she calls or texts him and is like, when are you coming home tonight, honey? So there's going to be some kind of a payoff there. She's going to show up. And I didn't expect her to help the protagonists, but I thought maybe she would be the one to deliver the coup de grace to her cheating no good man, but she instead just says to put his body on ice, which is just as good, I guess. Anyway, I knew she was going to show up, but I was still pleased all the way through this climax that at no point was there any like cat fighting, because so often movies like this resort to that. I guess the worst version of that would have been if, say, the bartender had shown up and he had killed Brendan, and then the three women captives had just wailed on the wife. So often there's like a weird segregation that happens in action movies constantly, where like the woman villain sidekick and the woman hero sidekick pair off and beat the tar out of each other, you know. And so I kind of appreciated that this movie didn't go that route, but that's how it ends, is the three of them, or actually no, it's just Molly and Noah at this point.
Yeah, Noah basically gets approached. The wife kind of pretends to have been another captive for all of 10 seconds just to get close.
Yeah.
And then tackles her to the ground and is throttling her. And then Molly, after having heard a scuffle, shows up with a shovel and caves her brains in. And they sort of recline exhausted against a tree. And, I love you. I love you too. And then we see Noah's phone and it's parentheses, maybe Chad, text message, you up. And,
yeah. Which roll credits.
Pretty dopey. But
yeah, I mean, it reminded me, I was late to the party on this one. I just recently watched Promising Young Woman, which I thought was okay, but the final shot bugged me. It's the camera zooms in on a winky emoticon on her phone where she's, spoilers for Promising Young Woman, gloating from beyond the grave.
Right.
I thought that was kind of a cheeky, incongruously glib note to end on. And here, I didn't dislike this as much as that, but it's the same kind of aggravating. So not the best note to end on. Even, if it hadn't ended with that shot, it still would have ended with the cat fight, which I am not the biggest fan of, but it is what it is. So more after the break. A digestif, is that?
Yes.
Okay. Close enough. More after the break.
Do you live around here? Because I live on aisle 6.
That was terrible.
It was kind of terrible.
What's his Instagram? I want to stalk a little bit.
He doesn't have one.
Say what?
Yeah.
Oh, no. See, that's shady.
Let's play a game. Tell me something you don't want me to know.
I
hate this.
Okay.
Put all our hopes of finding happiness through someone else.
Yeah.
Girl, you are all digmatized and I haven't even seen this dude.
What's going on?
I'm gonna tell you, but you're gonna freak out.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
No, this isn't happening.
Yeah, it's happening. No games. Is that what you wanted? It's about giving. Giving yourself over to somebody. Becoming one forever. That's love. Forget this.
And we're back. So, one thing I want to get off my chest right off the bat here. I enjoyed this movie. The biggest thing I think that bothered me is that we don't get enough of the wife. And, you know, you could have gone overboard and made her, like, too much of a supporting character, and that wouldn't have been good either.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, she shows up when Molly tracks down Steve's house, and there's that, like, 5-minute segment. And then she maybe shows up one other time before the climax. And other than the shower scene, where we see that she's an amputee and we're left to speculate exactly what the situation is there, we don't get any real examination of her role in all this, her position on all this.
Well, and their home life must be fascinating, you know, like whatever weird, kinky, sadomasochistic, cannibal shenanigans they've been getting up to. You know, we don't need to get into it in graphic detail, not because I'm squeamish, but just because I think it would kind of...
It would be a little bit hack.
It'd be a distraction from the main meat of the thing here, to use a loaded word. But a little peek behind that curtain would have made the cat fight, as I keep calling it, feel less like an afterthought, you know, if she'd been more of a fully fleshed out character.
Yeah, and the first place your head apparently went to is that this was a consensual amputation. The first place my head went, actually, was that she was basically the first iteration of Noah.
Yeah, that she was in Noah's situation and she charmed her way out of it. That's, very possible.
You know, like you say, you don't want to flesh that all the way out because that would just be kind of tedious. You don't need to have her go on a 3 or 4 minute monologue where she's just like, we met at a bar and... then he kidnapped me, and et cetera, et cetera.
We're just the same, you and I.
Right, yeah, we don't want that. But just give us a little something. Just give us a hint as to, okay, this is where her head's at, and this is where she comes from. This is the deal. And I would have very much appreciated that.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you have to do something to justify that being the final confrontation. I mean, Brendan is dead with his brains blown out at that point. It's not even worth bringing the wife into it in order to create another physical altercation. I mean, that's bound to feel anticlimactic unless there's some kind of substance to it or some reason for that to be the ultimate payoff. It reminded me of Antebellum, I think, ends kind of the same way, where, like, she, at the end of the day, Janelle Monáe, is that her name? She's being chased on horseback by, like, the wife of the plantation owner. And she, I think, has dispatched a couple men at that point. But it comes down to this chase where it's her and that lady who looked like she was straight out of Sleepy Hollow, a movie that I've constantly got on the brain, as recent episodes have made increasingly plain.
As opposed to Antebellum, which I have not
thought about once.
Well, that's not true. There's another movie that came out recently called Alice that's got, like, a weirdly similar premise.
Huh. I've not heard of that.
Except it's kind of like in reverse, where this woman who's enslaved in the 1850s or whatever suddenly finds herself in, like, 1970s New York.
Huh. Okay.
And apparently it's terrible.
I like
it has
that
in common with Antebellum,
right,
I guess.
The time warp aspect. That was one of the weakest parts of Antebellum because it didn't. It was so apparent what was going on. I remember us complaining about that. There was zero mystery there. I do like, I mean, if it's bad, it's bad. I do like that Alice is a double period piece. You don't see very many of those.
Right, right.
So I wasn't expecting, I went into this movie knowing virtually nothing about it. Obviously, the name Fresh has to do with fresh meat, but knowing only what I had gleaned from the Hulu blurb, which is that it was a meditation, you know, or a horror film about dating, I thought, and I'm sure this is something of a double entendre, you know, it's fresh in the sense of don't get fresh, you know, like don't be too quick on the draw, whatever, don't shoot your shot too soon,
too aggressively.
Yeah, right. And it really isn't about Tinder at all. That's kind of like a total Trojan horse. I mean, you could do a kind of cheeky, subversive thing wherein the movie, and this could have been really hack, but the movie could have made a point about how dating apps are kind of a meat market, you know, where people are selling themselves. And, you know, and I'm not that down on the modern state of dating. I think it's dehumanizing to a degree. But if the movie wanted to make those connections, it could have, and it mostly doesn't, which might be for the best because it's hard to imagine. You'd have to have a very light touch in order to not make that make your eyes roll out of your skull.
Yeah, that's a high risk, maybe high reward proposition.
Yeah.
to break down all that. Like, if you do it just right, it could really add some heft.
Well,
but
if you
do it even 15% wrong, it'll just be crap.
Yes, I agree. Well, and the payoff, the reward, I guess, high or low, I'm not sure, would be that the entire film would feel a little bit more cohesive than it does currently. There's sort of a bait and switch, and then that's all there is to it. The dating stuff is largely dispensed with, other than the you up text at the very end. I like both of the performances. I think Daisy something, is that
Daisy
her name?
Daisy Edgar Jones.
She and Sebastian Stan are really excellent in their scenes together prior to the title drop and then during the dinner scenes where it turns into more of a sick pantomime of their courtship from the beginning of the movie. The scenes where it's a more conventional hostage taker.
Misery
kind of situation is good but not great. But some of those dinner scenes do kind of leap off the screen in a way that I like. I like them, some of them, even more than, I mean, the Ray Liotta thing from Hannibal gets points for outlandishness, but it doesn't pack the same punch as the scene in the book did because, you know, for all the reasons I mentioned, because in the book there's that kind of squicky ambiguity to do with, like, oh, is Clarice, you know, how is she going to get out of this? Is she going to get out of this? Does she want to get out of this? And in the movie, that's just not present, which I think might be down to studio meddling. I'm really not sure. In any case, I think that Fresh gets at times like 60-70% of the way towards evoking that same kind of squicked out feeling that I associate with the book Hannibal, which I'm a big fan of. But you never really think that Noah's doing anything other than trying to get him to let his guard down. So it doesn't get 100% of the way there. But nonetheless, I like him in these scenes. Well, no, I mean, she's great throughout. His performance was a little topsy-turvy for me because the movie makes him out to be this sort of second string Patrick Bateman every once in a while. And I'm just a little bit over that, and it's not his fault. But he shines particularly in these scenes because it's like he thinks they're still just at the bar, you know, shooting the shit and getting to know each other.
Well, at one point he even says, hey, I understand the situation is a little different, but I'm still the same guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still the guy from the bar. It's like, yeah, but if I had known then what I know now, like, you may still be the same guy.
Yeah.
But now I know who that guy is.
Right. So he's deluded in a kind of interesting way that felt convincing in those moments, less so when he's prancing around, you know. Those scenes are okay, but they're just a little old hat, I think. I'm a little Well, I'll tell you why Tom Noonan was on my mind. He's never that far from my mind, but her
like Sleepy Hollow.
Her holding cell looks like Michael Mann did the interior decorating. It's got this like beach. It's like wallpapered with this beach image with these like with this deep orange sunset and these bright blue waves, and it looks like something that would be in the Tooth Fairy's house in Manhunter. He's got those like those Hubble photographs, those like floor to ceiling photo partitions.
Right.
And it just looks very, I don't know, very Miami Vice, very GTA Vice City, very 80s, very Michael Mann. And so I was thinking like, I like Manhunter. I like Tom Noonan. I wish that we got more killers every once in a while in movies like this who are a little more subdued. And I thought that's where we were going with Sebastian Stan. And then he turns into such a showboat every time he's alone,
right?
That and that, you know, I mean, I like American Psycho. I like a fair number of movies where the killer is a little bit of a drama queen like that. I just don't think it necessarily suited his character or this material, so that bugged me. It was weird, actually, that the scene of him dancing around while he's chopping up the lady's leg. Prior to that, I was under the movie's spell completely, and then after that, I was just sort of, you know, the movie did other things after that point that I liked, but it was never quite the same. I just kind of came to in that moment, and the movie never really hooked me again quite the same way, even though I do like some of those candlelit dinners.
It's interesting. I agree with you, the floor to ceiling sunset photos and so forth, very Miami Vice, very Manhunter. I'm with you there. I also think in other parts of the house, in other ways, there were two other films, very different, that setting reminded me of. And when they're outside the house, it's got like a wall all around it. And I don't know, the wall reminded me of nothing so much as the psychotic husband's house from Invisible Man 2020. Yeah. Psychopaths buy houses alike, I guess.
It is becoming kind of a movie shorthand for a particular kind of toxic male abuser archetype. They all live
brutalist
in houses. Yeah. Brutalist architecture. Yeah, exactly.
And in a similar sense, the interior of the house, the parts where like the walls, I don't know exactly what they're made. They basically look like bare concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Like not, you know, rough. They look like smoothed down, buffed concrete, but nevertheless, they're like gray slabs.
Mm-hmm.
And that interior reminded me more than a little bit of Ex Machina.
Oh, yeah.
Oscar Isaac's secluded mansion,
yeah,
house.
His fortress of solitude.
Gonna tear up the fucking dance floor, dude. I need to watch that again. I like that movie a lot.
Yeah.
Oscar Isaac, particularly. Choice. But yeah, so it's just another house with a crazy guy, although that crazy guy's a little different.
Mm-hmm. I think I kind of wondered how to what, you know, because he always acts, Sebastian Stan's whole shtick is like, well, I'm going to level with you. And then he says exactly what the score is, basically as soon as she comes to in the Michael Mann cage.
Mm-hmm.
And
I thought you were going to say the Michael Mann cave.
Which, very good. That would have been better. And basically what he tells her is God's honest truth. You know, I have these clients. They like meat and hair and weird shit like that. I'm going to cut off one piece of you at a time and sell you. And that's all there is to it. I mean, she's a commodity. I wondered to what extent he was playing mind games with her. Like maybe he was just some freak and the commercial aspect of it was just a pretense. And she was going to find out by degrees how crazy he actually was. Like what if there are no clients? That might be kind of interesting. And when she first started talking to Penny, especially once you found out the wife was in on it, I thought, okay, maybe he has a female co-conspirator. Maybe there are no other captives. And this is a war on several fronts. It's like good cop, bad cop. You know,
right.
She's confiding in this voice on the other side of the wall who might be in cahoots with her abductor. You know, there's all kinds of interesting directions this scenario could have gone. You know, in Misery, which I wouldn't have thought to reference other than you brought it up earlier, when James Caan comes to, he can tell that Kathy Bates is nutty, but he doesn't know quite what she's capable of. It's only after he starts sneaking around the house that he finds her photo album full of clippings about how she like murdered a shit zillion babies or something when she used to work in the maternity ward. That kind of stuff. You know, you find out incrementally, oh, you're Looney Tunes, you know, this is like, I'm in danger. And you don't get that in this movie because he does just put his cards on the table. And while that's sort of novel, I think it also creates diminishing returns in the back half of the movie. The only neat reveal is the wife's missing appendage. That's basically it.
Yeah.
So that's problematic. And him having this wealthy clientele, he calls them the 1% of the 1%. Although when he says, like, what you just ate was, I can't remember the price tag he puts on
$30,000.
$30,000. It's like, that's not the 1% of the 1%. That's, you know, I mean, that's not cheap, but, you know.
Well, it's also for one meal, though.
Well, yeah, that's true. It could be an annual thing. I don't know if these guys are supposed to be subsisting on an all-woman diet. That would be quite steep.
But yeah, I mean, you're not going to, even if you go to a 3-Michelin-star restaurant,
yeah,
for, if you're eating by yourself, you're not going to drop, you know, maybe you're going to drop a couple $1,000s.
Yeah, not $30,000. That's true. But I don't love that. It gets awfully Illuminati. There's
yeah,
montages of these guys. You never see their faces, really, maybe for a fraction
of a
second.
Well, you see like the bottom, their mouths,
you see them,
while they're eating.
You see them chowing down, and one of them is eating on a plate that has this very satanic
ram's head looking.
Yeah, or like a golden calf almost insignia on it. And that insignia shows up again under the credits, which I could have done without. Even the initial shot of the plate, I thought, was a little, just a touch Pizzagate, just a little too much, a little too much adrenochrome for my liking. And
yeah,
then the credits sort of drove that home. I thought, like, okay, this is, they're a cabal of, you know, of cannibals, which, and I can go in for that sort of thing. Like, I fucking love Eyes Wide Shut, which is all about that Illuminati milieu. But I think, I don't know if here it's just not distinct enough or if it just doesn't get enough attention. Something about it felt a little phoned in to me. Like, it was like trafficking in modern day conspiracy theories that I didn't, that it, and I don't really find that objectionable so much as just a little lackluster.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't like bother me because it's, I'm not saying that Fresh is QAnon propaganda.
No,
I don't think that at all. I just think that it felt a little lackluster to me, a little low effort.
Yeah.
The cleverest thing that happens in the whole movie, and it's during one of those candlelit dinners, of which I am very fond, is when she asks him, do you only eat women or do you only sell women? And he says, yes. And she says, why? And he says, that's where the market is. Plus they taste better. But the first half of that line, that's where the market is what I found so intriguing because it reminded me of Get Out for the second time, which is it's when the white supremacist maniacs are trying to justify. I think it's Steven Root who they give this monologue to. He says, like,
that would make sense.
It's just, well, it's not, you know, we're not racist. It's just a coincidence that all is black is in right now. It's trendy. It's what the market wants, basically. It's not that we're frothing at the mouth bigots. I would have voted for Obama a third time, blah, blah, blah. But that's, you know, it's cleverer than if they were just in the KKK. They're not owning up to their own racism. They think that what they're doing is much more benign, I guess, weird word to use in that context, but they don't see it for what it actually is. And the same is true here. Sebastian Stan doesn't find it puzzling that he only eats women. It generally seems like it doesn't occur to him that it's just part of his business model. It's not like a pathology or anything. So that's kind of amusing. And of the two bits that made me think of, I have three, actually. No, you've got Molly sleuthing around, you've got the bartender showing up at the end, and then you've got that line, it's what the market wants. Of those three echoes of Get Out, this bit to do with why women is the aptest, or it's the comparison by which Fresh suffers the least, let's put it that way. It's clever in the same way that Get Out was clever, which is not nothing. That's substantial. Overall, though, I didn't like it as much as I wanted to. It wound up reminding me less of Get Out and more of, you remember that movie The Perfect Host?
Yeah.
Or just very vaguely.
No, I know the movie.
Yeah, I liked it about as much as The Perfect Host, and I remember liking The Perfect Host well enough. It reminded me of movies of that caliber. Or, I mean, I liked it. It has some of the same audacity and just, can they do that? I can't believe they just did that weirdness of The Perfection. I liked it more than The Perfection. Perfection kind of got on my nerves. But, you know, it's those are the movies that kept coming to mind watching this. And on the basis of that overture, everything prior to the title drop, I thought that it was going to be a little bit artier, a little bit, not more high-minded necessarily, but just... It's sort of the same way I felt about X. You remember when I said at the end of our X review that the old lady getting run over felt a little tawdry?
Sure.
You know, there's just kind of a tawdriness to much of this movie that I wasn't expecting on the basis of that first half hour or so, which is, you know, and I like some really sleazy slop bucket horror movies where like tawdry would be much too weak a word to describe them. But when your preamble is a little bit artier and a little bit more high flown as it was in X and as it is here, then a climax that's just kind of slapdash and gushy can feel like a letdown, I think. Not a huge letdown, but a letdown all the same.
Yeah, fair enough. So in terms of recommendations, there are obvious cannibal movies that I can just check off right now. The whole Hannibal Lecter universe up until the prequel, which I haven't seen, but I hear is bad.
It's pretty bad, yeah.
I also haven't watched the show with Mads Mikkelsen, which I hear is better.
Yes.
But, you know, all four of the initial run of films have their merits. Red Dragon probably least so, but it still has some merits. So there's that. There's Texas Chainsaw, needless to say, the original. Mm-hmm. It is funny when Steve and Noah are doing their formulaic first date questions, acknowledged formulaic.
Yeah.
He asks where she's from, and then she reciprocates. He says, oh, I'm from Texas.
Uh-huh.
That only clicked for me like 45 minutes in.
Oh, I'm from Harlow.
Yeah, well, that would have obviously been a little too on the nose.
Yeah. Although, as I pointed out in our review of the new Texas Chainsaw movie, it's not a word or a name that comes to mind easily for me. And I'm, you know.
No, it just would, since we.
Like I said, Harlow is not Haddonfield. But right. It's fresh now.
Yeah, since we highlighted it in our lambasting several episodes back. One cannibal movie I will offer the strongest anti-recommendation I could possibly offer is Eli Roth's The Green Inferno.
Oh, right.
We've complained about that at length in other episodes, so I won't belabor the point, but that movie is dreadful, and it's about cannibal natives in the Amazon. Just gross in all facets. But I will recommend two other cannibal movies. Neither of them was particularly below the radar, but they're not, again, Texas Chainsaw or Silence of the Lambs, so I feel comfortable recommending them. The first is Raw, which, for those of you who don't know, is about a med student who, I forget exactly in what circumstance she tastes human flesh, but she develops a taste for it.
I think it's during some Rush Week antics, or maybe not. I mean, that the movie is largely about that. I think I might have recommended it when we reviewed Nocturne for that reason.
Yeah, that sounds right. Because
they're both movies about college freshmen getting in over their heads. I like you, I can't remember how cannibalism enters into it for her, although there's an element of predestination at play there, which I won't spoil.
Right. And the other movie I'm going to recommend is Bone Tomahawk.
Ah,
which is a good time. The first of S. Craig Zahler's brutalist action flicks. I think that's an apt way to describe his oeuvre.
Yeah. Well, the fact that I can profess to liking Bone Tomahawk and reserve so much ire for Green Inferno really is a testament to the fact that my scruples only, you know, they only account for so much.
Well, one's a good movie and one's not. They're both.
There you have it.
There are similar things that are objectionable between the two.
Well, I mean, I like Cannibal Holocaust, which is a moral affront on many levels, not least of which, you know, that they harmed animals and shit, which is indefensible by modern standards or even contemporary standards, you know, meaning like early 80s standards. Yeah. But yeah, Bone Tomahawk.
So it's a Western. It's got a whole slew of recognizable faces. most prominently Kurt Russell. And basically, people are disappearing out into the desert, and they're being captured by cannibal Indians, you know. Yeah. And it's the whole thing. Kurt Russell forms a posse to go rescue somebody, and it does not end well.
Yeah, because they're basically up against the Uruk-hai, which they don't know. And they've got the requisite indigenous character on hand to say, they're not Indians, they're not one of us. They're more debased, more savage, to use a loaded word. But yeah, I mean, it's a good time at the grindhouse.
Yes.
There's gore in it that makes Green Inferno look fairly tame, actually.
Ain't that the truth. So anyway, Raw and Bone Tomahawk. Those are mine.
Just because I've got more subdued movie slashers on the brain now, like your Francis Dolarhides in Manhunter, in Red Dragon, which, as you said, has its good qualities. One of those good qualities, I would say, is Ralph Fiennes' performance, although he is much more operatic and more, you know, like,
yes,
I am the great Red Dragon.
Rafe, are you in the room?
You know, so he's much more of a showboat, the word I think I used earlier.
Yes.
But in terms of cannibal movies where the killer is a little bit more low key, I've been dispensing with my hit list systematically as I get older and consume oodles and oodles of movies. But when I was a kid, I formed this agenda in my mind where I would peruse the horror shelves at Blockbuster and eyeball all the cover art and just sort of internalize, like, oh, that looks scary. And then, of course, the movie that you build it up to be in your mind is a good deal more frightening than what is actually on the DVD
yeah.
or the VHS tape. The cover for Ice Cream Man really freaked me out when I was a kid. And subsequently, I watched it, and it's like a goofy, like, slasher comedy kind of thing. Totally disposable, but, you know, harmless fun. But the movies that freaked me out the most were the ones, you know, straight to DVD stuff about real life serial killers. The cover for Gacy put the fear of God. Well, they put the fear of clowns in me more so than the fear of God. But, you know, that I recognized the names, even though I didn't know the when I was, you know, 10 or 11, the details of their grisly deeds. But Gacy and Dahmer, you know, it feels like half of the horror aisle at Blockbuster was like straight to DVD crap about actual serial killers. And so over the pandemic, I tracked down several of those flicks. The Gacy one is pretty much trash. The Dahmer one is actually, I thought, pretty good. And it might be just because I went in with rock bottom expectations, but it's got a pre-fame Jeremy Renner right. as Dahmer, and he kills it. I mean, he's got that aloof, quiet quality that Tom Noonan has in Manhunter, or Norman Bates, or Anthony Perkins is the actor's name, has in Psycho to a certain extent, although that's a little twitchier.
Norman Bates is himself. I don't know what you're talking about.
He's very withdrawn. And I remember it just being presented. It's not like a schlocky docudrama kind of thing. It's a little, I don't want to keep abusing the word arty, but it's a little artier than you'd expect. It's kind of presented non-linearly. And you just spend time with the guy, and it's not, I don't know. I mean, it's mainly a showcase for pre-fame Jeremy Renner. And I think I expected it to be the kind of movie that he would like everyone to forget he was in. And maybe he feels that way, but it's honestly a better showcase for his abilities than anything he's done in the last 10 years, probably, or at least anything that I've seen, you know, anything.
Yeah, Wind River's pretty good.
What is?
Wind River.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, no, Wind River is good.
Well, you've just got Marvel well, sure. on the brain.
Yeah, you know? No,
and, yeah, him being Hawkeye is whatever.
Well, and he's almost Hawkeye in Wind River. It's, you know, he's still like a marksman, but it is, yeah, a much more down-to-earth kind of actorly role.
Right.
And, you know, Hawkeye has his own miniseries now, I think, which might be good. I wouldn't know. I haven't seen it. In any case, I'm not trying to drag Jeremy Renner, get that paper. But Dahmer is pretty strong, actually, I think. So that's my recommendation for whatever it's worth. If you're tired of male killers in movies like this dancing around their kitchen like they're Tom Cruise in Risky Business, then Dahmer could be a good palate cleanser for you. I don't think he actually eats anyone in that movie, although he was famously a cannibal in real life, and the movie is buoyed by that. You get the sense that that's the culmination of all these crimes. There's one shot in that movie where he's just hit somebody in the head, or like bored a hole into their head, and they're not dead. I think they're just unconscious, and he just like plays with the hole a little bit, like a kid poking roadkill with a stick. And it's like really appalling, but in a very stripped down, not flashy kind of way. That's like the indelible image of that movie for me. And there's another scene, which is excellent, where he's living with his parents and he's got something in a box and they're trying to get the box open and he's panicking and you don't know what's in the box. You imagine that it's a human body part of some kind. But it doesn't even really matter. It evokes the same anxiety of like any teenaged kid living with his folks who like doesn't want them to find his porno stash. You know, he's just like freaking out like, Mom, stop it. You know, like that kind of thing. But it's like a guy's head in the box or something like that. It's I hesitate to say it's relatable, you know, but it does that Norman Bates thing where you sort of feel yourself, you feel for the guy and you are. I mentioned this in our review of X. You're rooting for him when the car doesn't go all the way into the swamp. You're like, oh no, the rear bumper is still sticking out. He's in trouble now. I didn't expect a straight-to-DVD serial killer movie from the early 2000s to be even remotely Hitchcockian or to be operating at that level. You know, to be playing games with audience allegiance, I guess. There's surely a better word for it. But it's not bad. It's not bad at all. You might, you know, it might behoove you to go in with rock bottom expectations like I did, but check it out.
Well, good luck now.
Yeah, right. Gacy sucks, though. So you don't think I'm completely off my rocker. The Gacy movie is pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll go ahead and wheel Fresh back into the corpse freezer.
Yeah, put it on ice.
Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
And I'm Matt Gerandaisi.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
A quick scheduling note. After watching You Won't Be Alone, we elected not to do an episode on it, as we felt it wasn't really a horror film. Given that, we skipped that release date and picked up with the next film on our schedule. Sorry for the unannounced change. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Fresh Official Trailer Hulu, uploaded by Hulu. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, May 8th, and we will be discussing Master, where Regina Hall joins the faculty at a haunted college in New England. See you then.